From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Lewis Katz.
And I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
This week on War News Radio, the costs of combat. We hear about the stigma associated with PTSD.
Then we investigate the U.S. government's billion-dollar contracts with the Boeing Company.
And finally, we discuss the pervasive human rights violations against women in Afghanistan.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Libyan rebels have taken control of the Misrata airport, the first break in a two-month siege by pro-Qaddafi forces on the city. Misrata is Libya's third-largest city and remains the biggest rebel holdout. The airport itself is southwest of the city center, deep into what was formerly government-held territory. Meanwhile, NATO airstrikes in Tripoli, the Libyan capital, have continued. Qaddafi himself has not appeared in public since April 30th, when a NATO bomb struck the house he was occupying with his family. However, the national television station has aired what is supposedly recent footage of Qaddafi meeting with officials, though the date of the film is unconfirmed.
Refugee agencies have been calling on the UN to step up assistance to those escaping across the Mediterranean from fighting in Libya. The vast majority of the refugees are migrant workers from sub-Saharan Africa, heading for the tiny Italian island of Lampedusa. Though the Maltese and Italian coast guards have rescued thousands from the waters, hundreds more have drowned, starved, or died of exposure on overpacked, unseaworthy boats. In one incident, 61 of 72 refugees died aboard a boat that ran out of fuel and drifted for 16 days. Survivors say they were given supplies by an emergency helicopter and were even within rescue distance of what was possibly a NATO aircraft carrier. NATO disputes the claim that any of its vessels were notified of, but failed to respond to the emergency.
Several members of Congress have now seen the controversial photos of Osama bin Laden's death, originally sealed by President Barack Obama. They were released to members of the Senate Intelligence Committee and Armed Services Committee and related House committees. Though all those who have seen the photos confirm that bin Laden is clearly deceased, members of bin Laden's family continue to request evidence of his death. Debate remains over whether the photos should be unveiled to the general public, as there is concern that they are disrespectful and would spark backlash among al-Qaeda supporters.
The New York Times printed a statement attributed to the adult sons of Osama bin Laden, criticizing his death without trial, his burial at sea, and the harm done to several other members of the bin Laden family. The statement was written at the request of Omar bin Laden, the fourth son in the family, who has repeatedly rejected religious violence and left his father's residence in 1999. The statement pointed out that Osama bin Laden was unarmed and that leaders of similar status, such as Saddam Hussein, had been given trials. It also demands that Pakistan release members of the bin Laden family currently in custody.
In his first interview since bin Laden's death, Pakistani Prime Minister Yousaf Raza Gilani defended his government to Time magazine. Gilani acknowledged that failures in intelligence allowed bin Laden to live in Pakistan unnoticed for an extended period of time, but argued that Pakistan alone is not to blame. Citing evidence that bin Laden traveled to Yemen in 2002, Gilani insisted that bin Laden spent time in other countries.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has said that he will consider asking the United States to stay longer than the December 2011 deadline for complete withdrawal from Iraq. Maliki said that he will consult with other lawmakers and come to a decision by late July, despite U.S. pressure for an earlier response. If a consensus, a term not well defined by Maliki, is in favor of a continued presence, he will back them. However, the hardline Shia Muslims that make up a strong faction of Maliki's supporters are most opposed to continued foreign assistance, though Kurds and Sunnis are in support of U.S. presence. Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, meanwhile, has threatened violence if U.S. troops remain beyond December.
Al-Qaeda in Iraq announced this week that it would support Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's second-in-command in al-Qaeda. Although al-Zawahiri is the expected successor to bin Laden, he has not officially been appointed as the organization's head. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is the first such group to publicly support Zawahiri. Zawahiri had previously clashed with al-Qaeda in Iraq over its repeated killings of Iraqi Shiites.
A new report released by Oxfam and three other groups argues that Afghan forces are not ready to take control of Afghanistan. the rights organizations claim that continued human rights violations, combined with a lack of accountability, mean that the Afghan police and military will be unfit to maintain security. In particular, the report focused on the sexual abuse of young children, high rates of civilian deaths, and the lack of a mechanism for citizens to address rights violations as important areas of concern. U.S. and NATO leaders argue that Afghan forces will be sufficiently capable by the time NATO exits the country in 2014.
Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh visited Afghanistan for the first time since 2006, backing the Afghan government and calling for collaboration between nations in the region. Singh pledged his support for the process of reconciliation between the Taliban and government officials and promised that India will be a partner in rebuilding Afghanistan. Singh stated that India will seek the friendliest possible relations with all its neighbors, including Pakistan, and that a healthy relationship with Afghanistan is not a threat to Pakistan.
In a ruling this week, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sharply criticized the Department of Veterans Affairs for failures in treating the mental health problems facing many veterans. In a 2-1 decision, the court decided in favor of two nonprofit veterans groups who argued that the VA has not provided sufficient services to assist those suffering from mental health issues. The court agreed with the plaintiffs that systematic delays, a lack of suicide prevention resources, and other sources of, quote, unchecked incompetence, unquote, meant that the VA was failing to uphold its constitutional obligation to effectively provide health care. In response to the decision, a White House spokesman noted that Obama has substantially increased the VA's budget and stated that the administration will address the issues brought up by the court.
War News Radio. Combat zones can expose a soldier to a great number of traumatic experiences, but finding peace after war can be another battle. The inability to escape those experiences define post-traumatic stress disorder, a condition that is widely publicized but not always widely understood. War News Radio's Carolyn Badden, working with producer Colin Smith, took a look at the different stigmas veterans with this disorder face when returning to civilian society.
Gerardo Mena, a decorated veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom, was in the field with his battalion when an improvised explosive device went off, killing and injuring several of his friends.
I don't know, when you're out there and your friends are injured, your sense of self kind of goes away.
Even now, years after he came home, the experiences still stick with him.
You know, I just couldn't understand why someone else was injured or killed, and I wasn't when I was there, and things just magically missed me somehow. I don't know why.
Mena has the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, a condition that over 100,000 U.S. military veterans have faced in this decade of war. However, many veterans struggle not just with the disorder, but also with the stigma associated with PTSD. This stigma often prevents them from getting treatment and going on with their normal lives. According to Paul Sullivan, a Gulf War veteran and the executive director of the nonprofit organization Veterans for Common Sense, there are two types of stigma commonly associated with PTSD. Here, he explains the first type, which he calls self-discrimination.
That's where the soldier who was in the war, or the Marine who's coming back from combat, or the veteran who's now home, feels afraid that they should not seek help and not tell people that they have a mental health condition.
Sullivan compares this to a veteran not going to the hospital for a broken bone.
So what we first have to overcome is the stigma that some soldiers, Marines, and veterans have, and that is that it is okay to seek care.
Mena knows this from experience.
Just the very macho attitude of our society has on being a veteran, like you should be a Rambo, or you should be person that just is so patriotic, why would you ever need help, that kind of thing.
The second type of stigma is called group stigma. Sullivan explains.
That's where an employer, or let's say a potential date, learns that a veteran home from the war might have a mental health symptom. And the employer will say, oh, I don't want to hire that person. They'll cause problems in my office or in my factory. Or maybe the prospective date will say, oh, they're a veteran. Well, I've heard stories about them. I don't know if I want to date and have a relationship with a veteran.
Andrew Stone, a psychiatrist who is the director of the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Clinical Team at the Philadelphia Veterans Administration Medical Center, has been treating veterans with PTSD for 25 years. Here he describes the origin of this social stigma.
Sort of the stereotypic negative image of combat veteran with PTSD comes out of some of the popular culture from the Vietnam era, movies like Rambo or Taxi Driver, the idea of the walking time bomb kind of character who is somebody with military training and a short fuse. And you don't know what's going to set them off, and they're not easy to be around, and they're maybe not even safe to be around. I think that was part of what there was to overcome.
When he went to college after returning home, Mena encountered similar reactions.
A lot of people thought I was crazy. So maybe I didn't do anything to really negate that stereotype.
Susan Kaplan, a reporter for the NPR branch WFCR in Western Massachusetts, attributes this to a culture that doesn't look kindly on mental illness.
I think the general perception that it's in somebody's head. If they all had cancer, we wouldn't question their heroism.
In the end, the costs of war are something borne not just by those returning from combat, but by those they return to as well. Andrew Stone reminds us of this shared responsibility.
This is perennial human activity that occupies a great deal of our national attention and our national treasure and your tax dollars and mine, and something that we all have a responsibility for. The primary prevention would be not to have the wars. If we are going to have them, we have to clean up after them.
The more we understand about the challenges our veterans face and the stigmas attached to those challenges, the more we can help veterans move forward. For War News Radio, with producer Colin Smith, I'm Caroline Batten.
This is War News Radio. Thousands of people fly back and forth in the Boeing company's commercial airlines every day. What these thousands may not know is that the Pentagon spends billions of dollars on government contracts with Boeing. The company provides the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, U.S. allies, and more, with products and services that could not be farther from those found at your local airport. Kate Aronoff has the story with this piece first aired in February.
According to their corporate website, Boeing is the world's leading aerospace company and the largest manufacturer of commercial jetliners and military aircraft combined. They pride themselves on being a global corporate citizen. Dan Beck is Director of External Communications for Boeing's Defense, Space, and Security Division.
The things that Boeing has produced over the decades have opened up the world to people from all walks of life. So we do feel a great responsibility as a global company. Feel a great responsibility, and we have an interest in making sure that we're doing the right things.
The Boeing Company is the third largest defense contractor in the United States, according to a study done by Washington Technology, a government contract trade magazine. The company itself reports that just under half of their revenue comes from government contracts. OpenSecrets.org, a lobbying watchdog group, reports that they were the top lobbyists last year from the aerospace defense industry, spending millions of dollars on Capitol Hill. Boeing continues to have a large presence both in the U.S. government and in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, contracting on everything from logistics to unmanned drones. Boeing has a long history of defense contracting, dating almost all the way back to its 1916 founding. The company began providing training seaplanes to the United States Navy in World War I and has continued to expand its involvement in conflicts since. Today, within the U.S. government, Boeing sells mainly to the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security. Dan Beck talks about this history.
Since the 1920s, the company has fulfilled military contracts, mostly for aircraft. And over time, in addition to growing as a commercial aircraft manufacturer. We have also provided military aircraft and other systems for U.S. and international customers right on through the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, and all of the conflicts leading up to Iraq and Afghanistan.
A large part of Boeing's defense projects involve aircraft. The company also provides the government with a wide variety of products and services, including training and satellite surveillance. Joseph DiNardi is an associate analyst at Stifel Nicolaus & Company, a firm which provides investment recommendations and market research for Boeing and other large-scale defense contractors.
The defense business consists of three separate units. They have a military aircraft division, so that they would make aircraft like the F-18, the C-17, you know, the tanker that they're currently competing in the tanker competition for, and then a couple helicopter programs. Then they maintain a space division where they make satellites for the DoD and NSA. And then they have a services division where they would provide, like logistics work for troops overseas or maintenance work for aircraft domestically.
Overall, the company consists of five divisions: Boeing Commercial Airplanes, Boeing Capital Corporation, Engineering, Operations, and Technology, a shared services group, and Boeing Defense, Space, and Security, otherwise known as BDS. This division, serving the United States as well as other governments and commercial buyers, accounted for 49% of the company's total revenue in 2010, amounting to well over $8 billion. Boeing is currently competing with an Airbus affiliate for a roughly $35 billion contract to provide the U.S. Air Force with a new tanker aircraft. This nearly decade-long dispute has been a contentious one for Boeing. The competition was postponed in 2003 when Darlene Droyan pled guilty in front of U.S. District Court of inflating the price of the contract. The controversy, which CBS News called the biggest Pentagon scandal in 20 years, was followed by the resignation of CEO Philip Condon and the termination of CFO Michael Sears. Despite these and other controversies, the U.S. government continues to spend billions of dollars in contracts and subsidies on the company. In December, the Department of Defense awarded Boeing an additional $10 million on top of a previous agreement. The Pentagon's proposed $671 billion 2012 budget could give the company a significant boost in government funding. The company may receive $54 billion in manned and unmanned aircraft procurement and research and development funding, 27% of the budget's allotment for all procurement and R&D work. As a means of securing its extensive government and commercial interests, Boeing spends a considerable amount of time and money on Capitol Hill, where it has lobbied on an array of legislation through the Boeing Political Action Committee, or BPAC. Boeing's website describes the committee as a voluntary, nonpartisan political action committee established by the Boeing Company in accordance with federal law. Last year, the company spent $18 million lobbying on issues from aviation and education to foreign relations and homeland security. Dave Leventhal is editor of OpenSecrets.org, a nonpartisan group which monitors lobbying efforts in Washington.
You look at all of all the different companies within the defense aerospace industry in particular, which is the industry that we classify the Boeing company in. They are number one as a defense contractor. It often pays to have a very strong and robust lobbying force because it allows you to really address a number of issues. It allows you to address a number of members of Congress and people in federal agencies and really have yourself represented to them on a variety of issues that you care about.
Boeing's involvement with the government, though, has not been limited to its lobbying and recruitment efforts. The company meets with government officials to ensure the development and distribution of their products and services. Dan Beck talks about this relationship.
So one thing that we're seeing now is more of a dialogue, more of an outreach on the part of the Defense Department to assess what the needs of the defense industrial base. There are large meetings with industry. It really is that kind of an exchange.
The New York Times last month reported on a leaked cable which revealed that U.S. diplomats had been acting as salespeople for the company's commercial airliners overseas. According to the NewYorkTimes.com, hundreds of leaked cables reveal a close relationship between the company and prominent government officials. In January, the World Trade Organization ruled that the company had received at least $5 billion in illegal subsidies from federal and local governments in the United States, according to the SeattleTimes.com. Joe DiNardi speaks to Boeing's investment approach.
For the most part, the management teams make their decision probably similarly to how they would make a decision that wasn't related to wartime activities, you know, whether it's going to provide a good return on investment. You know, I don't think that they look at whether the contract is associated with
The Boeing company makes its investments, like all companies, with a cost-benefit analysis. Whether they're producing commercial airliners or unmanned drones, Boeing's ultimate goal is to make a profit. For War News Radio, I'm Kate Aronoff.
This is War News Radio. According to the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, there were more than 1,500 reported cases of domestic violence in the first half of 2010. Further, women lack many basic rights, the right to go to school, to participate in government, to choose who they marry, even to leave their house to seek medical care during pregnancy. Amandine Lee brings us more on the complex reasons behind the abuse of women in Afghanistan and what needs to be done to stop it. This piece first aired in August of last year.
Problems for women in Afghanistan are widespread and varied. And, according to Wajma Foh, an Afghan journalist and activist, they have been around for a long time.
The issues that the women of Afghanistan have not really changed. These are the issues that we had 50 years ago, like basic, very, very basic access, like access to your health, access to education. Every 30 minutes when women loses life due to very basic matters, mortality or pregnancy-related complications. And similarly, access to education has really shrunk in the past few years as the security and the Taliban insurgency has increased much more.
There is a noticeable dichotomy between the countryside and the cities in Afghanistan. Matthias Tomchak is the director of the Support Association for Women of Afghanistan, or SAWA, Australia, an organization that sends money to women's NGOs in Afghanistan.
Women in Kabul, they can go to university, they can get jobs mainly with NGOs, particularly if they are computer literate and can speak English. These are the two requirements to get a job anywhere in Kabul, more or less. In the countryside, women are basically still the property of men. The economy is basically agricultural and poppy growing, of course, which is the business of the men, and the women just have to stay home and do the cooking and bear the children. They depend entirely on their husbands and other relatives, and if the husband is a nice person, then they have a reasonable life, although they are locked away from the world. And if the husband is a misogynist, then they suffer severely.
There's a huge foreign presence of troops and aid organizations in Afghanistan who support women's rights. But some consider the warlords who in practice run Afghanistan huge perpetuators of the problems that affect women. Tomchak explains how the troops may strengthen the warlords.
Millions and millions of dollars are paid to local warlords to get security for the transportation, and if they don't pay that, they get attacked. They are extreme misogynists. They don't allow girls to go to school. They support early forced marriages. And the whole story of Afghan women's suppression.
Wajma Foh, however, considers their presence necessary.
A lot of women activists and I myself, we believe that if we didn't have the international troops, we wouldn't have reached where we are today. It actually opened the whole door for us.
However, the way that NGOs have gone about helping women has actually created a violent backlash from men who resent their efforts.
what we have been doing in the past 10 years is creating this women-only space in which men have been really blamed. There has been so much focus on women-only programs where men thought that they felt kind of deprived from those opportunities. That didn't help. That actually created a backlash. The men who are very much angry, the men who think that their opportunities are being taken by women, they have to be brought forward. They have to be part of this process.
What's more, singling out women ignores the nature of gender relations in Afghanistan.
Women are not like the women of the other world, for example, who are able to make their own decisions. For example, for me, like I live in a rural family, but still, like, my father is the head of the family. I can't do anything very much against him. We are very much linked to each other. So in that way, you can't separate people.
In addition, changes in women's roles are linked to the Soviet and communist eras, when they were forced on Afghanistan.
So women in that regime, in the urban areas, for example, they became a sort of symbols of communism. And communism was very much resented against. Only Kabul, for example, was supportive, but not the provinces. So now when you have the same, for example, progress for women, when you see women wearing Western clothes, when you see women going to school, when they are working, when they become teachers, so then it brings those memories back to the local communities thinking that, okay, maybe it's the same government, maybe it's the same approach of trying to take out these women out of home. So it is very political.
There's also the worry that new ideals are disrespecting older values.
Maybe the foreigners are here to liberate the women in a negative way. It's an Islamic traditional country with all those sort of values that they believe in. So they think those values are being challenged, those values are being kind of like mockery of these values.
That being said, there have been a lot of liberal reforms in Afghanistan since 2001. Matthias Tomczak says, however, that in practice they are not enforced.
The Afghan constitution is really only a piece of paper. If you read it, you think that it is a progressive country. The minimum age for marriage is 16, but there are still girls being married at 10 or 12 years old.
One thing that has worked, Wajmafo says, is the 27% quota for women in Afghanistan's legislature. Though democracy in Afghanistan is weak, it empowers women and gives them an opportunity for them to interact with men on the level of equals.
For example, I remember that some people came from Helmand to see a woman MP, and the man was saying that, before I was even embarrassed to talk to a woman who was not part of my family, but now when I hear her talking about water, asking for power, asking for schools for my village, then I become proud of this woman. I came to create support and to create a sort of to show my support to these women.
And Fo emphasizes that the abuse of women is not entrenched in Afghanistan's culture. With the right tactics and the enforcement of the laws, it can change.
It has little to do with the tradition. I'm always against this idea. I hear in the media that it's because of our culture. It's not because of our culture. Look at India. 30, 40 years ago, India had a worse situation than Afghanistan. Women in India were going through very severe violence. But things changed because we worked with women in the grassroots. At the processes I was talking about, they did empowerment. At the same time, they involved men. And also the government became serious in implementing laws.
For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Amandine Lee, Aaron Moser, Jared Nolan, Sam Hirschman, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Louis Katz.
And I'm Eliana Biscard-Church. Until next time, thanks for listening.